This week is the cricket commentator and former West Indies fast bowler Michael Holding, known as Whispering Death on the pitch and for his mellifluous commentary off it. He is a cricket legend, widely regarded as one of the greatest fast bowlers in Test history. Born in Halfway Tree, Kingston, Jamaica, he made his debut for his home island aged 18 in 1973. He played in his first Test match for the West Indies 2 years later, becoming part of a team who would go on to make sporting history, not losing a single series for 15 years. In that time, he bowled what many cricket historians regard as the greatest over in Test history to the English batsman Geoffrey Boycott. Retirement brought a second career. His euphonious delivery, combined with an intimate knowledge of the game, made him one of the most respected broadcast commentators of recent times. He moved beyond the boundary last year. When rain stopped play, he delivered a powerful monologue on racism in sport and society. It won him numerous prizes, including a Royal Television Society Award. And it was, like much of his career, unplanned. He says, "A lot of things I've done in my life, I never planned them. I pretty much live my life as it comes. When I played Test cricket, it wasn't like I ever sat down as a little boy and said, I'm going to play for the West Indies." Michael Holding, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Thank you very much, Lauren. Glad to be here.
So, Mikey, you might not have planned it out, but it has been an impressive career, an integral part of the most successful West Indian cricketing era, commentating on the game for over 30 years. How does it feel when you reflect on all that, as we will be today?
I feel very lucky, Lauren. To be honest, I feel very, very fortunate, because my life could have been so different but for this game, cricket.
You've said that this is your last year in the commentary box, and I know so many people will miss your beautiful voice. You've also been a very straight-talking commentator, though. You're unafraid to speak the truth about what's going on in the game. How is that received at home, I wonder?
In the Caribbean, I've been called biased before. You talk about somebody from Trinidad, he doesn't like Trinidad. He doesn't like people from Antigua. He doesn't like anyone from Guyana. Eventually, when I criticized the Jamaican, where I am from, they said, oh, I don't like that particular person. But that's just the way it is. After a while, although some people might not like some of the things that I say, they respect what I'm saying. So I don't worry about that too much.
Cricket fans will know that you're not too enamoured of the new razzmatazz in the sport, Mikey. This 2020 format, these short, fast matches, though, they are growing in popularity. What if you're on the wrong side of history and this is the future of the game?
Maybe it is. I have no idea, Lauren, because I can definitely see that that's a direction in which the administrators are going. They keep on giving lip service to Test cricket and they keep on talking about it's the ultimate game, but they have even shortened it more, Lauren. They now have a 100-ball game. So they'll move from 120 balls now to 100 balls.
Your lifelong passion is Test cricket. What fires your imagination about it?
Because it is an ultimate test of character, of skill, of longevity. You go out and play a 120-ball or 100-ball game, and a batsman, for instance, goes out there, he gets 45 runs from 15 balls, and he comes in and everyone tells him he has done a great job. 15 balls, Lauren. 15 balls. You go out and you bowl 4 overs and you may get 2 for 30. They say, oh, you have done a fantastic job. For 4 overs, can you do it for 10, 12, 14, 16 overs? That is the true test of someone's ability, not 4 overs.
Well, we're going to talk more sport, but of course, we've got to make time for the music, and we're about to hear your first disc today, Michael. How have you gone about choosing your selections today?
Well, most of my selections are from my early days. They have a lasting impression on me. Now, this first one, for instance, is when I just had one television station in Jamaica, and we used to hear Dionne Warwick on a Sunday, and we used to just make sure that we never missed it.
So why have you chosen this particular track?
Because I want to tell people, this is what I am. Don't try to make me over. Accept me as I am.
Don't make me over.
Don't Make Me Over, Dionne Warwick. So, Mikey, I want to take you back to July 2020. Rain had stopped play during the TV coverage of a test match, and you began an impromptu speech that would become a four-minute monologue on institutional racism. This was in the wake of George Floyd's death. You went on to win numerous awards for your eloquence and passion, and you were speaking from the heart, weren't you? It was completely unscripted. Tell me about that moment.
Yeah, well, you know, these things have been bugging me and in my mind for decades, but I just let it just wash over me and I move on. And, you know, Lauren, I just wish that we could come to the point in life where people just see people as people and people stop seeing religions and races and genders and that sort of a thing. And we are just people. And it just came out. It just came flowing. I didn't even realize it. I had spoken for 4 minutes.
Yeah, well, you said something really interesting, though, when you were describing it. You said, I had those experiences and for a long time I just shrugged them off and moved on.
Every time something happened to me, I shrugged it off. Because I said to myself, I don't live this life in Jamaica. I'm going back to Jamaica when I'm done, and this is something that I'll just put behind me. I don't have to live it. But after a while, after coming to England so many years, and then being involved in the society itself, meeting so many Caribbean people here in England, it started to wear on me, to be honest. Mm-hmm. It was not just something I could keep on shrugging off.
I think you once said, Mikey, if I'd grown up in the UK, I would be dead now. What do you mean by that?
When I was a young man, Lauren, I was a little bit fiery. If people remember my cricketing career, I kicked out a stump in New Zealand in 1980 because of my fiery nature at that point in time. Mm-hmm. I've mellowed a lot. I have calmed down a lot. But growing up with that sort of fiery temperament, I could have done something that I should not have done. And especially if I had lived in America, I wouldn't have gotten to teenage.
Mm. You said that, you know, you didn't and don't experience racism at home in Jamaica, but it was when you left that it started to come into focus for you. What happened? When did, you know, do you remember the kind of earliest incidents of that?
Yeah, the earliest incidents were in Australia. Happened in a lift where the door opened, the gentleman saw us and refused to come into the lift because perhaps he felt intimidated by the black men in the lift. But as the door was closing, he shouted a racist remark. You know, those sort of things. But what I keep on telling people, doing a Lauren, although these things happen, I've had a lot more positive experiences in Australia, in England, wherever, than the negative ones.
Mm-hmm. And there has been so much discussion about players taking the knee before games in cricket and in other sports too. Some critics argue against players apparently allying themselves with the more political elements of Black Lives Matter. I wonder what your perspective is.
Black Lives Matter being a political movement, I don't really care about. I care about the three words, Black Lives Matter. People with black skin, their lives matter. That's what I care about. So all those who are looking for little pieces of thread to try and unravel the entire situation, it's because they do not want change. They cannot give me any other reason for trying to unravel it.
Mikey, it's time for some more music. Disc number two. What is it and why are we going to hear it today?
Well, this one is War. You know, Bob Marley is saying, until the color of a man's skin is no more significant than the color of his eyes, he's going to have war all over the world. This song, actually, doing a Lauren, is Bob Marley taking a speech by Imperial Majesty Haile Selassie from Ethiopia and turning that speech into his song.
Until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes, Mr. War. That until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all without regard to race, it is a war. That until that day,
Bob Marley and the Wailers and War. Bob Marley, of course, Mikey, synonymous with your home country, your mutual home country.
Yes.
I wonder if you've ever crossed paths.
Not really. The closest I got to meeting Bob Marley was one day driving along in a halfway tree area. We came up to the clock tower where there were traffic lights. I stopped my vehicle right at the front and a blue BMW came up beside me. And I realized it was Bob Marley. So he looked at me, I looked at him, I nodded at him and he nodded at me, and then the lights changed and we drove off.
All right, Mike. Well, I want to take you back to Jamaica now, obviously, and to your family there and growing up. Your mother met your father at church. Yes. She was Enid, he was Ralph. But apparently some of her family were quite unhappy with the match between them. Why was that?
Yeah, because of the colorism in Jamaica. And colorism stems from racism, because the racism factor makes you believe that the more pale skin you are, the better off you are, the more likely you are to get forward in life. And she was a brown-skinned Jamaican. She wasn't white. She was mixed. My father, black. Anyone looks at me can see how dark I am. So if he and her produced me, you can just imagine how dark he was. And so her family didn't want her to be associated or to be getting married to a man like that.
It sounds like she knew her own mind, though.
She's, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I think you've described her as a disciplinarian.
Very much so. Very much so. Lauren, my mother was a teacher, eventually a headmistress. So you know what that sort of discipline that entails. And she was always adamant about education and learning and bettering yourself. My father never got a piece of paper behind his name. My father was a self-made builder, contractor, architect. Mm-hmm. But my mother was always a stickler for discipline. Mm-hmm. She never ever meted out the punishment, because I was a little bit wayward as a kid. I couldn't sit still. You know, when they were going to cricket, for instance, on a Saturday, they would be cooking everything on a Friday night ready for Sabina Park on a Saturday. And the Saturday morning, I would disappear, because I did not want to go to cricket at Sabina Park, because those days you just sit in a chair all day, and there was no way I was going to sit in a chair all day. So I would disappear, and when they realized that they can't find me, they would have to go to cricket.
Thing you said about your dad, that he was the strong and silent type, but woe betide you if you stepped out of line. I am getting slight foreshadows of Whispering Death there. Did you grow up to take after him a little bit?
Yes, I think so. My father was never excitable and never someone to make a lot of noise or to shout about anything. He was quiet, but he did what he had to do.
You were born in 1954 in Kingston, Mikey, and you were the youngest of four children by quite some margin, I think.
Yes.
You were the baby of the family, and your sister Marjorie says that you were thoroughly spoiled, but not badly behaved. How fair is that?
Yeah, they say my mother spoiled me. They say she allowed me to get away with a lot of things that they did not get away with. But I got a few bits of punishment. I got some serious walloping at times.
Before we talk more about your early days playing sport, Mikey, I think we better have disc number three. What are we going to hear next and why?
This now is one that I again remember from my youth. And this is my early encounters now with anyone from South Africa, Miriam Makeba. And this is a song that pretty much made her world famous, called Pata Pata.
Pata Pata is the name of the dance we do down Johannesburg way. And everybody starts to move as soon as Pata Pata starts.
Miriam Makeba and Pata Pata. So, Michael Holding, your first experience of playing cricket was in scrubland behind the house in what you've called the organised chaos of Catchy Shubi.
Catchy Shubi, yes.
With cork and tar balls. I'm going to have to ask you to talk me through this a step at a time.
Well, we couldn't afford to buy leather balls. And the cork and tar ball was a black ball that was painted red, just to make it look like a nice red leather ball. But the entire thing about the game, Lauren, is that it taught you all different aspects of cricket. Mm-hmm. For one, everybody wants to bat. The only way you could get to bat is to bowl the batsman that's batting and to hit the stumps. And with stumps, we used corrugated iron so that when the ball hit it, it made a loud noise, because if you use anything else that did not make a noise, the batsman would say, oh, it didn't hit, you know, it missed and whatever, because there are no umpires. If you're in the outfield and a ball goes high in the air, you don't just settle on it and take a nice, comfortable catch. Everyone wants to take the catch. So people are pushing your way and fighting to get to the ball to take the catch. So that's where the shubi came from.
Okay.
The pushing in Jamaica.
Shoving. Yeah,
shoving, but we call it shub.
You progressed pretty quickly, and you were playing informal matches for Melbourne Cricket Club, and they involved curry goat matches. What are they?
What we used to do is go out into the rural areas on a Sunday. And why they are called curry goat matches is because every time there was a match like that, a goat was killed, and that was lunch. It was such great fun as a little kid with these big men, because I'm 11, 12, 13 at the most. Mm-hmm. And these guys are 18, 19, 20. I know they consider them big men, you know, upstanding men in the society.
So was that the point that you started dreaming ambitious big dreams?
No. No, I never had any ambitious big dreams. I just played and had fun.
Mikey, we've got to make some time for the music. This is number 4 today. Tell us what we're going to hear next and why you've chosen it.
Again, this goes back to my youth. A gentleman that used to go out to my sister, and he had a car, and of course his car had a cassette deck in it, and one of the first cassettes he got was of the Winstons. It's called Colour Him Father.
I love this man, and I don't know why, except I'll need his strength until the day that I die. My mother loves him, and I can tell by the way she looks at him when he holds my little sister Nell. I heard her say just the other day that if it hadn't have been for him, she couldn't have found her way. I think I'll color him father. I'm gonna color him love.
Color him father, the Winstons. Michael Holding, you made your first class debut at 18 years old. What do you remember about that day?
Almost 19 though, Lauren. I was almost 19. What I remember is being extremely unfit and not knowing. People had started talking about me because I had done very well at school. Now I'm playing against big men and I think, oh, I've got to charge in. So I charged in, first over, second over, third over, fourth over. By the end of the fourth over, I was walking down the fine leg and I'm saying to myself, please, Lord, don't let him call me for a fifth over. I was dying. I was out on my feet.
It was just 2 years later, though, 1975, you were chosen to join the West Indies team and tour Australia. What do you think Captain Clive Lloyd saw in you?
Well, I think he saw potential. I don't think he expected me to play in Australia. I think he perhaps said to himself, we'll take this youngster to Australia, 21 years old, best place to go and learn to bowl fast, good fast, bouncy pitches. He'll learn, he'll come on that tour. Mm. But it just so happened that they selected me in the first test.
So you gained playing experience, but sadly, it wasn't a very happy time, that tour. There's a press photo of you in tears on the pitch at one point. What went wrong?
Yeah, that photo would have been Sydney, which would have been the fourth test match. And the first ball after tea, I got rid of Ian Redpath. Out, gone. Second ball after tea, everyone knows except the umpire, I got rid of Ian Chappell, caught behind, and the umpire said not out. I couldn't believe it. I don't think too many people in the stands could believe it either. And because I was so inexperienced, so naive, I went out of the extra cover region. I went down on my knees and I started to cry.
The
injustice of it. I just could not believe it.
There was also some squabbling within the team, I think. You must have been pretty disillusioned about cricket and your future in it when you got home.
Well, when I went home, I told my father I wasn't interested in West Indies cricket anymore. I told him if that is West Indies cricket, I don't need to be a part of it, because we had a lot of squabbling and a lot of infighting in that team.
So by the time you got home, you thought, right, I'm going to study and get a proper job, and we could have lost one of the greatest fast bowlers in history to banking or computing. But then Kerry Packer, the Australian businessman, invited you to play World Series cricket. How did that change things for you?
Changed my life totally. I was at university. Remember, Lauren, 1975-76, I had gone to Australia for about 3.5 months, played 6 test matches, and I earned $600. And this man is now showing me a contract. $25,000 per year, guaranteed for 3 years. So that blew my mind.
Mikey, we will find out what happened next. First, though, we've got to hear your next disc. It's number 5 today. What have you chosen?
What's Going On by Marvin Gaye was one of the first protest songs. It was a big hit.
Marvin Gaye and What's Going On. And Michael Holding, listeners might not be surprised to know that you singing along with every word and have quite a fine voice, I must say.
No, not at all, not at all. My brother had a fantastic voice.
So, Mikey, your first overseas tour to England came in 1976, and that was the year that the England captain, the South African-born Tony Greig, made comments, which he has subsequently apologised for, about making the West Indian team, quotes, grovel. How did what he said affect you and the team?
It spurred us on, Lauren. It spurred us tremendously, because for that comment and that particular word to be coming from a South African, during the apartheid era, we didn't take kindly to it. And whenever he came to the crease, the fast bowlers found an extra yard or two of pace. And the other English batsmen didn't like batting with him when he was at the crease. But later on in life, Lauren, and this is what education is about, I got to understand that Tony Greig was in no way a racist. He just used the wrong term. And again, looking back, 1976, at the Oval, the last test match, when we made over 600 runs in an innings and beat them by lots, when the England team was leaving the field for the last time, and the West Indians started to shout, "Grovel, Greggy, grovel," he went down on his hands and knees and crawled the last few steps off the field beyond the ropes and then stood up again to walk inside. Racists do not behave that way.
I just want to compliment you on the understatement that you slipped in there. We beat them by lots. Just to unpack that a little bit, in one game in that series, I think you ended up taking 14 wickets.
That was the same test, the last test.
To the uninitiated, can you explain how formidable that is?
Well, there are only 20 wickets to be taken in a test match, 10 in each innings. And I got 8 in one innings and 6 in the other, which, of course, is a record for the West Indies. And, you know, it's not something that you do every day.
That's your record and it still stands, right?
Yes, it still stands as a record for West Indian fast bowlers.
Winning was a huge source of pride for the Caribbean. But I know that on that first tour, you also learned how much it meant to the Caribbean diaspora. You played an early practice match against Surrey, but your fans weren't happy that you weren't playing to win.
Yes, when they realised that we were not chasing the target, the mood changed immediately and they started to jeer and shout abuse. And I am brand new to England, so I am perplexed. I am wondering, why are these people behaving like this? But then Gordon Greenidge is the person who said to me, because Gordon grew up pretty much here in England, and Gordon said to me, "Mikey, these guys want us to win every game we play because they feel good about themselves if their team, coming from where they came from, can win, because they figured if their team could win on the cricket field and be respected, they had a better chance than of being respected off the cricket field, because they felt they were not respected in this country." And that's the first inkling I got of it.
It's time for some more music, Mikey. What are we going to hear next, and why are you taking this track to the island with you?
Another Day in Paradise is what we're going to hear next from Phil Collins. And again, it's about people not recognizing the good fortune that they have.
She calls out to the man on the street. He can see she's been crying. She's got blisters on the soles of her feet. She can't walk, but she's trying. Oh, think twice, 'cause it's another day for you and me in paradise.
Phil Collins and Another Day in Paradise. So, Mikey, I want to talk to you about your bowling. Now, I've seen many videos of you. There you are, far off in the distance, and then you turn and you begin this long, graceful run up towards the crease. It earned you the nickname Whispering Death. Why?
Actually, it's Dickie Bird, the world famous umpire, who gave me that name. And I said, Dickie, what's this Whispering Death thing? He said, well, Mikey, you know, when I was umpiring, you started so far back, I couldn't hear you coming. I had to keep on looking behind me to see if you were actually running in. But what about this death thing? And I never killed anyone. He said, yeah, but you could have.
And I mean, he wasn't wrong, was he? Cricket was a dangerous sport back then.
It still is.
But the 70s was also an era of minimal protection for batsmen.
No protection, no helmets, and even the pads. Lauren, I remember my first tour to Australia, center size 76 against those quickies down there. Gunn, Greenidge, Viv Richards, Lawrence Rowe. All of them took, Clive Lloyd, all of them took bath towels and stuffed down the front of their pads because the equipment wasn't that good then.
Wow.
To make sure that when the ball hit the pad, it didn't go straight through and hurt them.
And the speeds, you know, the ball could be flying at them at 90 miles per hour.
Yes. It was pretty quick. Clive Lloyd and myself ended up in hospital the same night in Sydney. He got his on his chin, I got mine in my eye.
Oh, wow, that must have been scary.
Yes, but we just considered it part of the game, Lauren. You know, fast bowlers, you're going to have balls whizzing past your head. It's up to you to keep your eyes on the ball and to get out of the way.
And the bouncers, for people who aren't so familiar with cricket, they were particularly controversial, and they are kind of as the name implies.
Yes, it's directed at the batsman's body. You know, it's, people will tell you, oh, you shouldn't have intimidation in cricket and in fast bowling, but that is what the bouncer was meant to do, to intimidate, to find out if you have got the strength of character to stand up there and deal with it, Lauren. I never wanted to hurt someone. What I wanted to do was intimidate them and to frighten them and or for them to play a shot that they were incapable of playing and getting themselves out.
So it is a game of cat and mouse that you're playing with the batsman in lots of ways.
You're playing with the minds. You're playing with the minds a lot.
You're known for the perfect over against Geoffrey Boycott. Talk me through it. 14th of March, 1981. Barbados, the Kensington Oval.
Yes. Boycott says it's the best over ever bowled because it was bowled to him. The circumstances were just right. I ran in and bowled from the very first ball as fast as I could, and luckily it went where I wanted it to go. And that entire over was pretty much almost perfect. After defeating Boycott, I think four of the first five balls, one hit his glove, fell short of Joel Garner at gully, and the last one hit the off stump out of the ground, and the entire ground erupted.
It's often referred to as one of the greatest moments in cricket. It's been immortalised in books. It's even got a poem written about it, but I don't think you think it was your best.
Not really, Lauren. You know, people get emotional about things, and because it was Boycott, and because, you know, the packed crowd and the eruption of the crowd and the pictures that were taken, and people got carried away with all that. But me personally, I think I've bowled better than that on different occasions.
You were ready for retirement when it came along in 1987, I think. How difficult was it to decide to step back from the game at the highest level?
It wasn't difficult at all, Lauren. I was ready for retirement 2 years before I actually retired.
Mikey, we'll find out about the next chapter and you stepping into the commentary box after your seventh choice today. What have you gone for and why?
And this is a great song. And throughout my life, I have got to appreciate this more and more, and it's that's what friends are for, very important people in your life.
That's what friends are for. Dionne Warwick, Stevie Wonder, Elton John and Gladys Knight. Michael Holding, your first stint on the radio doing commentary was, I think, for a one-day international, the West Indies against Pakistan, 1988. It's a very particular skill set. How long did it take you to get the hang of it?
It took me quite some time to feel comfortable. I was very nervous. I was very conscious of what I was saying, and because irrespective of what people think, English is not my first language. When you're growing up in Jamaica, we speak a lot of patois. And I spoke very slowly initially because I wanted to make sure I pronounced every syllable, even when I wasn't supposed to be pronouncing syllables. But it took me a long time to be comfortable and to flow a bit more and to stop worrying about making mistakes.
Mikey, throughout your life, your other passion, I know, has been horses. Yes. And horse racing. When did that love affair start?
That started from my youth. When I was a kid, my brother's godmother, who was our next door neighbor, owned horses. And so he used to go down to the racetrack with her in the mornings, cutting grass and taking it down there to feed them and that sort of thing. And I got more and more interested in horses and the athleticism of the horses and the fact that you could go to the stables and pet them and that sort of thing. I just kept on growing till I got to the point where I started to own horses when I started to play cricket.
And what did you love about it?
I just love being around horses. I love the entire camaraderie in the stables as well, Lauren. I've made a lot of friends in the industries, whether they be trainers, be jockeys, or just grooms.
What about when your horse wins? How does that thrill compare to taking a wicket?
Not just taking a wicket. That is a bigger thrill to me than taking a fifer in a test match.
What's and a fifer?
Fifer means you have taken 5 wickets in an innings, which doesn't happen very often. I only did that 10 times in my entire career. I tried to describe it to my wife once and she couldn't understand. But believe me, winning a race and going out there and holding on to those reins and leading that horse into the winner's enclosure, that gave me more pleasure than taking a 5 wicket haul.
Well, you've got one more tune to play us before we send you away with your Desert Island Discs. What's your last choice today, Michael Holding?
This last one, again, I'm going back to Bob Marley. And again, I'm going back to my youth. There was an expression in the Caribbean that we use, and in Jamaica in particular. They say, a throw me stone, whoever it lick is them ball out. Meaning, whoever the stone hit, that person will cry out. And whoever the cap fits, they will wear it.
And who the cap fit, let them wear it. Who the cap fit, let them wear it. Said I throw me corn,
throw me corn.
Me no call no foul,
me no call no foul.
I say in cup, cup, cup,
cup, cup, cup.
Clap, clap, clap.
Bob Marley and the Wailers and Who the Cap Fit. So, Mikey, I'm going to send you away to a different island. I am giving you the books to take with you as well as your discs. You'll have the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. You can also take one other book of your choice. What will it be?
I'm going to take a book which is about Nelson Mandela, Long Walk to Freedom.
You can also have a luxury item. What would you like?
I'm going to take a football. I can't take a cricket bat or a ball because I have no one to play with. I can play football on my own.
And finally, which one track of the 8 that you've shared with us today would you save from the waves if you were forced to do so?
The one that means a lot to me. That's what friends are for. Friends are very important in life.
Michael Holding, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thanks for having me, Lauren. Thanks for having me, for sure. I enjoyed it.